Hey guys, what up? It's your host, Ryan Sketch, here at Sketchbook Audio. Hey, thanks for tuning in today because I've got some excellent news. I have a great interview coming up here shortly. It is with my friend and author of an incredible book series, D.L. Jennings. That's Dave Jennings. He is a 14-year United States Air Force vet, and he's also a phenomenal writer. But don't let me spoil that for you here. You're going to have to watch the video and the rest of the interview to know all of the juicy details. So stay tuned. We're coming right back at you. And get that rolling.
Awesome.
Okay. Let me roll with a good epic song. I think that we need to start out with.
I know. Immediately Bohemian Rhapsody comes to mind, but that's like 3 minutes into the song. So,
well, we can fast forward.
Or Through the Fire and the Flames by Dragon Force. Those are my two epic song picks. They're on very different sides of the fence.
That they are. That they are. I was just going to play the Lord of the Rings soundtrack, but then that takes 4 hours to get to anything.
Yeah. No, that's not going to work.
Okay, so here we go. We'll just have this in the background for the moment. So we are live here at Sketchbook Audio. And today is a really big day. Today's a great day. Not only is it beautiful outside, and I finally got to see Los Angeles and San Diego because there's no smog. I guess that's the one positive silver lining. And I don't want to say bone. I don't want to make it out to be necessarily a good thing that we have this pandemic. But I mean, the fact that we can see things that we couldn't see before, I think that's mind blowing. But today we're getting a chance to see something even more mind-blowing, and that is somebody else on this podcast. And today marks a very special day. A good friend of mine, D.L. Jennings, Dave, he is a phenomenal author. But also, and the reason why I have him on the show today is because he's an artist, as I see it. He's a wordsmith, and I think being able to paint stories with a book and words and your mind and your thoughts and your dreams, that's just as much as an art using my little stylus here or a paintbrush. So without further ado, I would like Mr. Jennings here, who is live with us on the Instagram, sketchbook_audio, to say hello and introduce himself.
Thank you. And like you said, I am I'm a writer, but I basically developed my – I had no idea I was – actually a writer until I was in my about 32, I think. I had been in the Air Force then for about 10 years, and I was on a deployment to Africa. Okay. Where I was just bored out of my mind, and I knew that I had to find some way to kill the time, basically, because, you know, you can only play Candy Crush so many times. So I was reading some fantasy at the time, Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series, and okay. I kind of thought to myself, well, maybe I could do this fantasy, maybe I could do this writing thing. So that was when I first started writing, and it's been the greatest gift of my entire life. So I did 14 years in the Air Force. I have two books under my belt now. The second one is dropping in August. And I am lucky enough to be speaking right now with the guy who designed the cover for it. So,
shucks. Okay. So you mentioned, it was in the service that you decided you were going to write, but, yep. And not just write, but actually put something down that was in a solid book, which yeah. By the way is no easy feat. I attempted it myself and had since dropped that ball a couple times, but did you write anything before that? I mean, who goes from playing Candy Crush, for instance, to just saying, screw it, I'm gonna write a damn book. I got this.
You know, it was a large leap. I'd never done anything long form like that before. But I did blog the hell out of Survive Journal in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I think that counts. None of those are published, but they're still floating around on the internet somewhere. So I think that counts for something. But other than that, honestly, no. I'd excelled in my English classes in school, but
not me.
Never tried my hand at you know. Well, that's why you draw.
This is very accurate.
You use pictures good, no words.
I'm paid to draw, not to read or write or anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, did you ever try poetry? Just curious.
I would definitely say I made a very poor attempt at poetry.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I was an emo kid, so I'm pretty sure like all of us, you know, we all tried poetry at some point.
Yeah.
A
few times.
But nothing, you know, nothing really like very serious. You know, I'd write the occasional, you know, stanza of, you know, something, but, I'm big on limericks, but that's about it.
Okay. I tried haiku for a while, but I think it was just because my uncle is super into the whole Oriental. Well, is it kosher to say Oriental anymore? I thought I heard somewhere that
Oriental is for objects, and I believe everything else is for like Asian is for people.
Okay. So, okay. So we'll stick with that. So Asian culture. Yeah. He's very into that. He's very into the influence there. And he handed off a couple of haiku books to me and said, you know, this will help you bring down your passionate side, meaning I was very loud and aggressive sometimes. So it helped settle me. And, you know, and who would have thought that six words in a seemingly non-cohesive format would, you know, tame the tiger, so to speak.
There's a lot more to haiku, I think, than people realize too.
Oh yeah,
it doesn't translate well into English, from what I understand. Like in Japanese, it's a lot more structured and sort of complicated. And it's not just 575 like we've read. You know, you can't just spit out 575 and have a haiku. Apparently, there's like, you know, it needs to have a contrast of ideas as well. But you know. Whatever, like 575 for the American, for the average American, that's going to be a haiku. So,
man, I didn't even remember that. It's been so long since I actually put any poetry down on paper that, yeah, there's, you know, the stanzas and the verses, the refrain, anything like that. I think I remember heroic couplet as like your iconic Shakespearean type. Limericks. So that's about all I got right now.
Yeah, makes sense.
So, okay. So you have book one, right? Just a brief synopsis, because I really want to jump on to book two, because that's a big news for you right now. But book one, I read it. In fact, my wife is in the process of reading it. I've gotten that book off to a couple other people. I think some people recently just got Audible or...
Yes.
Yeah, Audible format. So they picked that up, and so far they seem to really like it. I prefer reading it, but sometimes for those long drives, you might just want to listen to it. Plus, and we'll get to this in a second, I think you did the voice or the words.
I did.
You did the reading of it. Okay.
Yep.
So book one.
So book one is called Gift of the Shaper, and it's I drew pretty heavily from Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time.
Okay.
Of course, the great epic fantasy. I like to describe it as a David and Goliath story, but in this case, Goliath is a god. So it follows Thornton, a young blacksmith whose father is taken away. Thornton isn't sure why, and it basically follows a wide cast of characters and sort of unraveling exactly what is happening. And there are two sides in this war. One side is trying to free this god called the Breaker of the Dawn from his prison. The other side, Thornton's side, is trying to trying to prevent that from happening and keep him in prison. So it's, you know, this celestial otherworldly kind of tug of war back and forth between two sides.
Sure.
You know, and there's war, there's the typical themes that you're going to see in a fantasy novel. It's not too heavy on the magic. I sort of took a page from George R. R. Martin's book in that respect, so okay. to speak. Where, you know, he's in a fantasy world,
mm-hmm.
but you wouldn't really know it except for the, you know, giant dragons flying around or whatever. Yeah. Magic doesn't really play as huge a part in his story as typical, like, sword and sorcery,
okay.
Fantasy. But, in mine, it's got a little, you know, there's gods, of course, and there is a sort of a magic system, with two sides to it. That I sort of delved into, but I think that's basically the gist of Gift of the Shaper.
Sure.
The first book.
Now, you said there's kind of two sides of things. Do you see that as a yin and yang type relationship, or, you know, two sides of the same coin? Or
I think so. I definitely do. I really like the idea of, you know, balance and opposition, and the kind of thing that yin and yang, represents.
Sure.
I also, you know, I think I was kind of, influenced by Robert Jordan, and then to a lesser degree, Terry Goodkind, who did, the Sword of Truth series. Some people might be more familiar with the TV show that it was adapted from called, Legend of the Seeker.
Oh yeah.
In both of those series, there's two sides to the magic system.
Mm-hmm.
In Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, it's called Sidin and Sidar, and it's like, you know, one is wielded by men and the other by women.
Sure.
And then in Terry Goodkind's, there's additive magic and subtractive magic. So, like, for example, subtractive magic is like, it could take this beard away from my face. Or additive magic is the other side of the coin, which is like, you know, you can create fire or something like that.
Okay.
So I really liked that idea. And that was how I did the magic for Gift of the Shaper was, so there's breaking and shaping are the two magic systems in my book. And, breaking involves being able to resize or move objects.
Okay.
Whereas shaping is like, I look at it as sort of like an alchemy, like you can change the properties of something, like,
okay.
for example, turning the air into glass or something like that, or creating fire out of nothing. So,
okay.
But yeah, like you said, I really do like the idea of those sort of the opposing forces that are also, you know, equal. I definitely like that. And I'm sure I was influenced by it, obviously being, you know, I didn't mention it before, but I was a Korean linguist in the Air Force. And so I studied the Asian culture very closely for about a year and a half, and that
wow.
That no doubt had a heavy influence on me, and even some of the language in the book and stuff like that.
Okay, that's the whole Asian influence is great because there's, you know, we get a lot of. Really good stories, well, as I've seen them anyways, from those cultures, particularly Japanese and the Korean. And what comes to mind for me is like The Alchemist and there's a witch one. It's more of a kid's one, but deals a lot with magic. And then, there's a few other ones out there that, you know, they're real heavy into magic, both on the dark side and the light side, and
yeah.
what they do for people. And while they're both, or they're all dealing with magic in some way, shape, or form, they're not the same. And I like the fact that you have your own system in this book. And, you know, you can say magic and anybody can say, okay, so Harry Potter, right? Or some other
yep.
version, or Lord of the Rings, there's magic involved there. But they are their own kind of magic. And
That was
awesome.
Definitely something that I was extremely cognizant of when I went into it. I didn't want to be just another, you know, Lord of the Rings ripoff. I didn't want to be your typical Dungeons and Dragons casting fireball and lightning bolt. I set out to have a magic system that was different And I wanted to, for the very purposes of being, you know, set apart, and people just talk about it like, oh yeah, no, there's this whole magic system and it's new. That's one of the things that I really like about Brandon Sanderson too, who's like, probably one of the most prolific fantasy writers of our time. Dude just cranks out like, you know, 5,000 page novels every 6 months.
So yeah, like it's
he's a machine. I swear to God, he is not from this planet. But one of the hallmarks of Brandon Sanderson's writing is that he always has a very well thought out and well structured magic system. One of his books that I really enjoyed, well, the series, was the Mistborn trilogy. And in the Mistborn trilogy, there are the magic system that exists there is it involves like ferromancy. I can't remember exactly what he calls it, but it involves the manipulation of metals.
Okay.
So they will ingest certain metals and they burn them, use them up in order to gain certain powers. Okay. Like, for example, seeing at night or being able to push or pull an object. And it's just so, I love it because it's so structured and you know exactly, you can work within the rules of this magic system where it's like, you can't really have a Deus Ex Machina where it's like, oh, the wizard saves the day at the end because he just used magic.
Right.
But, you know, it's great because it grounds this otherwise very fantastical element. You know, magic exists solely in, you know, the fantasy realm. That's like basically what it's known for. But the way that Sanderson does it, you're kind of confined. It's giving Superman his kryptonite, right?
Yeah.
It raises the stakes for you, and you know that there is going to be you can only get out of a situation in certain ways, in so many ways, because of this magic system. So I definitely enjoy that about his writing.
So two things. You mentioned Dungeons and Dragons, and that's awesome because Dungeons and Dragons is, first of all, it's been around forever, right? And it's so deep and involved that it's kind of off-putting in the sense that you almost want to have experienced it from almost day one, but it's also so well-developed that it can bring you in even at a later time in your life or just different generations. And between the video games, the books, the board games, and the dice playing games, or the role playing, it's awesome. It's very well developed, and you get to make it your own. So how much Dungeons and Dragons have you played?
Well, I'll tell you, I am involved in two games as we speak. I have a Sunday game and a Tuesday game.
Nice.
But when I was a kid, that was what really got me down the fantasy path, I think.
Okay.
I started playing with my best friend Josh and my younger brother Matt. And those two were responsible for so many hours locked in a basement, rolling dice and making up character names and stuff like that.
Sure.
And that, I think, was honestly one of the things that shaped the course of my life, was playing Dungeons and Dragons, because it got me so focused. It got me into the world of imagination. You know, it got me looking at certain scenarios and thinking, I'm not just a regular human now. I have powers that are outside my normal limitations. How can I solve this crisis or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely credit Dungeons and Dragons with a lot of my, sort of the cultivation of my imagination and being able to, grow up and kind of be engrossed in these fantasy worlds. So D&D was absolutely huge for me, and I'm super glad that I still play.
I found out the other day, and I think we talked about it, I can never pronounce his last name, but Joe Manganiello, that guy, the actor.
Yeah.
He plays.
Yeah. The dude from, I know him from True Blood.
True Blood.
Like,
yep.
What was it? I can't remember. But yeah, he was the sweet beard,
yep.
Flowing, luscious black hair, great body.
Yeah. Well, that's why Sofia Vergara is married to the guy. So.
That makes a lot of sense.
You know, but he plays, and that's just nuts. You wouldn't expect this guy who's like an American badass to be, you know, sitting at home hunkered in a basement with a group of people.
I saw an ad on my my Facebook feed for like playing Dungeons and Dragons with him. It was like, it's like a contest to play D&D with him. Yeah, you're right. Like, you know, he's just like this super jacked dude. And he's like, you know, total badass with the cool sunglasses and the sweet beard and flowing hair and stuff. And he's like, roll to see if I critical hit with my lightning bolt. And it's like, oh man, he's exactly like me.
He's a nerd of nerds, and it's great. It grounds him. Speaking of grounding, you mentioned a little bit ago when we were talking about kind of your system of magic and somehow being able to ground it into sort of reality. It reminded me a bit of, I was reading a backstory on Michael Crichton, and I've read every Michael Crichton book. I know his history like the back of my hand, but that was his big focus, was making sure that his books were somehow in some way grounded in reality. Now, we know that over time, Jurassic Park has some fallacies to it. But it almost doesn't matter. You know, we can come up with all of these facts to prove or disprove whatever magic he was creating. But it was cool knowing that, okay, this wasn't just a guy who was writing to write and wrote a good story by happenstance. He wrote something that was from his experience, not only in college, but in writing medical things. I don't know if you knew this, but he wrote a lot of medical journals, and he was trying to be a doctor originally. And in order to be that and pay for his schooling, he wrote these books and these scripts. One of those scripts being,
ER?
ER. Yep. He wrote that, and it sat in his trunk for months and years, actually. And then he finally got the script off, and they were like, okay, this is your way into not only writing, but in film. So he grounded everything he did in my wife is giving me side facts, so she's fact checking me. Michael Crichton wrote to be as authentic as possible, and I like the fact that, and I'm sure a lot of your readers, which by the way, we've had a few people show up on this already, and that's good. So hopefully people are learning about D.L. Jennings here, Dave Jennings, and his awesome book series that's out now, the Highglade series, right? And but Michael Crichton had that way of convincing you that it was real. And your books have a pretty solid way of convincing you. And it's probably because of your experience not only reading past authors, but in playing the Dungeons & Dragons and learning that there needs to be, like you said, you can just throw balls of fire and lightning, but what does it mean to the rest of the story and to tie everything together to it so it actually makes sense? So I think that's part of what really makes a great author so powerful in their words. And speaking of being powerful, you're on book two. So yeah. That's a force to be reckoned with. You want to make a trilogy out of this, right?
I am writing book three as we speak. I'm about 20,000 words into it. So
20,000 words. I put that
somewhere solid, somewhere around a solid 10%. Okay. I have about 150,000 word target, which I think is pretty reasonable. The first two books were about 125,000.
Okay.
So in terms of consistency, I think that's probably what I'm just aiming for. And again, that's just an aiming point. But the thing I'm struggling with now is I want to make, like you said, I want to make it a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely struggling with, like, can I actually wrap this all up in three books? Because there are so many, you know, I've developed so many characters. The very nature of epic fantasy is that it's told in an epic way.
Sure.
My book is no exception. Both Gift of the Shaper and then book two, Awaken the Three, which I think might be a confusing title for a second book, but I was like, whatever, it's cool. It makes sense in universe, so I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, I have so many of these characters that have become important to the story, some in minor ways, some in major ways. But I don't write a character that doesn't have a bearing on the story. So it's just, to me, I'm like, I find myself in the same sort of conundrum that George R. R. Martin found himself in early on in his writing process, which was, how do I tie up some of these loose ends?
Okay.
I was definitely, I was sort of kicking myself because I had this, spoiler free, I was struggling with one character who should have had a resolution in book two. And I really think it would have made sense to have concluded her story arc in book two, but instead I carried it on to book three. And now I'm just like, that was a mistake. Oh God. So, you know, it's like, that's one of the struggles that I'm dealing with now. But, the whole writing and the whole creative process obviously spread out through the number of years that it takes to write a book, can be pretty draining. So, it's become more work. Well, I don't know if I'd say it's become more work than fun, but, I still enjoy writing, but now I'm just like, all right, I need to get this done. I have to go do this.
Yeah. So book two, real quick, a quick glance, because this just came out. I had the privilege, and some of your friends and family had the privilege of reading sort of like a demo tape, so to speak. And man, the first one I thought was perfect, and then you followed it up with the sequel. So real quick, what's book two about?
So book two carries on the events of Gift of the Shaper. And it deals a lot with sort of the events that happen around Thornton and, and Mira. And basically without giving spoilers of book one to explain book two. But in a nutshell, Awaken the Three is about trying to awaken these three gods. They're called the Traveler, the Holder of the Dead, and the Ghost of the Morning. And these three gods have certain powers, some evident in their name and some not so much. But Thornton and his friends want to awaken the three. They need specific help from these gods. And there are other people who are trying to prevent that from happening because these gods are, in fact, very powerful.
Sure.
Not only that, but they're also dangerous. So it sort of follows these two sides again, with the struggle between one trying to awaken these gods so that they can have, so that they can get what they want, but also this other side who's trying to prevent that from happening. And, there's all these other side clashes that are going on in the meantime, sort of other plot points that are developing, some characters from book one that I expand on. Basically just a lot of some more world building and a little more plot development. But I personally think that book two is better than book one. It's my favorite child so far. I'm very, very happy with it. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I'm pretty sure everybody else will be very excited to read, especially if they've already read book one. Sometimes I'm an idiot and I will pick up mid, I think I started with Harry Potter with book four and I went back and read, I bought all the other ones and my buddy gave me the rest of them. So I finally finished that series, but, years ago.
That was actually something that I considered. I definitely, when I was reaching out for beta readers, right when I finished my first draft, I wanted some people to read the book. I specifically asked for people who had not read book one, so I could get their insight in on it. I was definitely writing it with the idea in mind. If someone were to pick this up right now, how much of the book would they understand if they had never read book one? Okay. So that was absolutely something that I considered. And I do a lot of, I do some recapping in the first couple chapters. It's like, hey, this character, you remember he did this thing in Gift of the Shaper. There's some of that. And, I didn't want to just absolutely pollute it, but, know, I also figured there were some people who have read book one. You know, Gift of the Shaper came out. It launched in 2018. It's been 2 years. Sure. There are some people who might not remember exactly what happened in the first one. You know, sometimes when I watch a Netflix series where I'm watching season two, I'm like, I don't remember any of this. What the hell happened in season one? So you get that sort of recap that they do for you. And I sort of tried to do the same thing in Awaken the Three.
Okay. I have a funny feeling that we're going to see a lot of that gap happen with COVID-19 and a lot of the film industry just being completely wiped out. So yeah. We're all sitting here cliffhanger. Our series are shut down until God knows when. And when it happens again, you know, I think a lot of people are going to storm back to Netflix, Disney Plus, whatever these streaming services to binge watch as much as they can to catch back up. But, that's really cool that you considered that, because there's probably only two times where I've jumped in. You've read Dragon's Pern. All right.
Anne McCaffrey.
Yes. Anne McCaffrey. Her series. And then, like I said, Harry Potter, I jumped in on, what was it? Order of the Phoenix or the Goblet of Fire. One of those I jumped in on, and it was like, I probably should go back and read the other ones, but especially since, you know, it's a school, you're going throughout the school year or their term at Hogwarts. But I got another question here. Okay. So my wife is asking a question that I've actually had on my mind too. And we've bounced this idea back a couple times, and from a video gamer and a movie buff, if you were to see your story developed into a Netflix series, a movie, a TV show, or a video game, first of all, which one would you want to see it go down first? And two, you know, is this a series worth, or is this a movie that turns into, like, you know, Harry Potter style or Hunger Games?
Phenomenal question. And I should mention that I am adapting the screenplay for Gift of the Shaper. I'm doing that myself. That's just sort of like a more of a passion project than anything. It'd be neat to shop it around and see if I get any bites. But sure. I think it would make an awesome video game, personally. You know, I have zero coding capability, so I couldn't do the video game myself.
Me either.
But, you know, as an RPG fanatic, I would absolutely love to play Gift of the Shaper. I think there would be some seriously awesome potential there. You know, a couple characters might be a little overpowered, but, you know, I think there's enough lore that exists in the world to sort of build on that.
Sure.
And, you know, that is something that's been done before with, like, if you're familiar with the author R.A. Salvatore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who actually follows me on Instagram. So hi, R.A., nice. If you're watching. Yeah, hopefully he's putting by, but, you know, you never know. He did the world and the myth building of Kingdoms of Amalur, which was a video game that was developed, I want to say, in the mid-2000s, maybe somewhere around then. Sounds Unfortunately, good. They only made one because the company that was doing it went under, I guess, which was super sad because it was a great game. It was super fun. But I think that, you know, fantasy stories lend themselves very well to video games.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the RPGs have that fantastical element to them. I mean, the two genres, well, like role-playing games are so interconnected with fantasy. It's really hard to name one that isn't, you know, kind of like fantasy derived, or at least like the science fiction derived, where, like, you know, you got your Fallout series, which is like sci-fi.
Yeah.
But almost like every other single RPG that I could think of off the top of my head is rooted in some sort of fantastical element. And I think it's because we all have inside us that desire to be greater, you know, to break the bonds of typical your restrictions that we have around us, and to be powerful. You know, I think it's a human nature. It's human nature to want to be better,
yeah,
to want to overpower things, and to want to better yourself. And fantasy, I think, is one of the best vehicles for doing that.
For sure.
So,
I want to give anybody who's watching, not just my wife over here, the opportunity to ask a question. So if you guys are watching and you have a question for Mr. Jennings here, please do ask. I have one more question while we have a little bit of time left. Dave, first of all, actually, do you still have a good amount of time left? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to take you away from that 100,000 word goal. That's nuts.
Exactly. Dude. Thank you.
So the question I have is, well, first, real quick, about, you know, it being a video game. That would be nuts, because Lord of the Rings is still, I don't know if you knew this, but Lord of the Rings is still churning out video games that have almost nothing to do with the original crew. We're talking about people who dealt with the the dark spirits of the Seven Kings that Wraiths.
Nazgul.
Nazgul. Yep. There's a whole game series based on that, and then there's like mass RPG games where, you know, you're playing more like World of Warcraft and Final Fantasy XIV, where the map is just endless, but you're playing with characters that they're not key icons in any of the storylines, but they happen to be important to side stories. And I could definitely see your book, especially now that you have that map on the back of book two, that just opened up literally all whole new worlds of potential. So, but my question is, and this goes to the cover of your book, why? So we talked about a couple potential possibilities for book cover ideas. Why was that one so iconic to you? And why would it mean so much to the people who read it?
The real answer, not that I'll, the answer that I won't give in any other interviews, is because it looked the coolest, I think. I love the idea. So you're talking about the cover for book one or for book two, right?
Honestly, either, but book two, yeah.
Okay. All right. So I figured you were asking about book two, but I love the idea. So, the front is, you see this mysterious traveler in the, in sort of a desert environment with his, like, you know, post-apocalyptic robes wandering the desert. You see a skull in the foreground and a wolf in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked that specific, imagery because I actually reference it in the book. And it comes from a specific passage where it's talking about the three, mm-hmm. The traveler, the holder of the dead, and the ghost of the morning. And the three are each represented visually on this painting that takes place in the book. So I figured, you know, what better way to have a cover than something that was actually just visually depicted in the book already. So I thought that would make like a pretty awesome looking, cover, which was exactly why I did that. There were a couple other ideas that I had. I am not artistically gifted at all. I can't draw for shit and I don't have a very good visual imagination. So I'm a little envious of people like yourself who have artistic ability and who can draw. My brain does not work like that. I work a lot better in words. I really do. And it's just always been that way for me. But there were a couple other ideas that I tossed around, but none of them seemed to be visually appealing as the idea that I eventually landed on. And I don't think I have. Yeah, I stupidly forgot to bring a copy of my book with me, even though I came out here to record the audiobook. But I, you know, I was going off the PDF, fortunately, that I had on my laptop. So. Sure. You know, it wasn't a total loss, but yeah, I wish I had. You don't have a copy. Oh yeah, you don't have a copy yet. Yeah, I know. It's on. We opened up for pre-orders officially on May 11th, and it drops August 11th.
Okay.
Which I'm just ecstatic about. I'm super excited. You know, I've been doing I learned a lot of lessons, frankly, from book one, mm-hmm. From Gift of the Shaper, that I am employing in book two to try and make it a success. There's a lot of promotion that goes on behind the scenes that it's like, I had no idea about any of that for book one. And I really honestly think that if I would have known that going into it, I think it would have had a little better chance to succeed than it did. And I'm very excited about book two and the possibilities of it. And frankly, people who read book one are also extremely excited about it too, which like makes me feel great.
Yeah.
You know, that's something an author always wants to hear is like, yes, I enjoyed your work. I definitely look forward to the next installment. That's like, there's no greater compliment than something like that.
Here's one compliment that you mentioned in your live stream for your release of book two, which
we're going to go get some coffee.
Okay. Get some coffee. Get the energy going. You mentioned where your book is positioned in bookstore or where it will be positioned in bookstores. Your name sits between some pretty big names. And how does that make you feel?
Yeah. I love that you mentioned that. I'd almost forgotten about that. And the reason I know that is because one of my friends on here actually works at the, and Amanda is her name. And actually I'm going to see if she, that's too late. She's not on here, but she works at the Harvard Co-op, which is a bookstore in, as the name would suggest, Harvard. And she is like, I didn't ask her to do this, which is my favorite part. She reached out to me and was like, I loved your book. I work at a bookstore and we have requested to have your book sold here. And I lost my mind. I was like, you're what? Oh my God. You know, I have an independent publisher. I have a small publisher. We do most of our sales. 99% of our sales are through Amazon and Barnes and Noble online.
Okay.
So that was the first time that my book was actually in a bookstore, which, you know, to me was like absolutely huge. That was, oh my God, like an incredibly cool moment. And she sent me a picture of it and it was wedged right in between N.K. Jemisin and Robert Jordan. And for anyone who's familiar with fantasy, they will know those names. But some people who might not be familiar with them, of course, I spent the first 10 minutes of this podcast talking about Robert Jordan, who's my hero in all things fantasy and in his life. The dude was a veteran, by the way, helicopter pilot in Vietnam. When you talk about people to aspire to, that guy is like my hero. But N.K. Jemisin is an African-American female author who won the, it was the Nebula Awards for, I think, books two and three. And then she won the, my mind is blanking on the other award. Not the Nebula. I can't remember the name of the other award. It's escaped me right now, but it's essentially the biggest name in science fiction and fantasy awards.
Sure.
And when you say like these are books that have won these awards, you know, there's only one of them given out every year. So you look up the winners of the Nebula for fantasy. There's only one author. There's one name under it for every year. And she won it two times in a row, which is like it was unprecedented at the time. It was just like these are two of the giants of fantasy. And then there's my name stuck right in the middle between them, which is like, what is happening here? You know, it felt like I had been called up to the majors. You know, I'm like a I'm a AAA ball club pitcher who's all of a sudden has to face Aaron Judge in Game 7 of the World Series. And it's like, what am I doing here?
You're making great stories, is what you're doing, and you're earning your place. So, frankly, don't doubt it, because that's where those books belong. And hopefully, with this, and then any other. You're on a roll with the interviews, first of all. And then second of all, I think with book two, when it actually releases, now people will be able to buy the book August 11th, right? But they can pre-order it now?
Correct.
So
yep. It's up through Barnes & Noble. .com and Amazon.com.
Okay.
You just search Awaken the Three D.L. Jennings and it'll pop up. Yeah, I was super excited when it dropped. I had like a whole pre-release party and everything like that. So
I think once these dates get closer, you're going to start to see, I hope you do start to see a huge flux in people just jumping at the opportunity to read your story. If they haven't read the first one, you know, and they just jump on the second one, whatever. But if they, you know, once they read the second one and they go back and read the first one, it'll be worth it. But if they read the first one, they're going to want to read the second one. And then subsequently the third one, once we get to that point. But, you know, man, you, from a person who started serving our country and just played the fantasy life, and enjoyed this kind of the themes that you're writing about, you know, the books read like somebody who cared and who wasn't just writing to make a book and make a quick buck. You wrote to write your heart and be an artist. And that's what Sketchbook Audio is about, is talking about art in different forms. I know typically I'm typically a car designer, but I started off with drawing cartoons and animations, but I wanted to change that a little bit. But I wanted this podcast to be for people who art in many different ways, whether it's crafting with beads and clay to drawing cars and dinosaurs to people who write books. So we're running a little bit over the time I wanted to keep you pinned down for this, but is there anything else you wanted to say about the book or yourself? And you got quite a few people watching at this point, so get it out there.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for stopping by. No, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. This has been a passion project for me. I'm super happy that I am able to do this. I always explain to my friends who look at me and see me as an author that – there are levels, there are different levels of success when it comes to writing. You have your J.K. Rowling's and your George R.R. Martin's who are basically stars in the NFL. You have your other, the vast majority of writers are playing at a D1 college, right? They're trying to get that draft into the NFL. They're trying to get picked up by, you know, one of the big five, as they're called, one of the big publishing houses. And then there's people like me who are walk-ons on a Kent State team or something like that. So, you know, I'm still hoping to get my shot at becoming a walk-on in a D1 college. So maybe one day I can play in the NFL. But there's a lot of work to be done, and passion is the one thing that keeps me going. And I'm very grateful for all the support of all my friends and my family. Frankly, I don't know if I'd keep doing it if I didn't have such a positive reaction to everything I've written and everything I've done. And there are some very, very just, extremely vocal supporters. Some of my friends who are like, go out, get them. You know, you're doing a great job. This is a really good book. And that keeps me going. That 100% keeps me going. Cause, I have a day job. You know, it's like, I have to support, you know, I always make the joke. It's like, I work to support my writing habits. Because like,
not your drinking habits.
Writing, yeah, exactly. Maybe one day writing will pay the bills, but, not yet. So I'm still working after it, and I'm still, you know, I got two books under my belt with hopefully a third coming out. And this is just something that I love doing. I love, one of my favorite things to do is make people happy. And I really enjoy like the excitement that comes from people, like, especially after they finish the first book. Sure. Usually the reaction is, oh my God, when is book two coming out?
So, yeah.
Thankfully, I finally have an answer for them.
August 11th.
Which is really exciting. So, well, like I said, I'm in talks with the publisher to drop the price of the Kindle version of Gift of the Shaper down to about $2.99. It was supposed to happen already, but Interestingly enough, Indigo River, who's my publisher, has partnered with Simon & Schuster, which is one of the big five, for the distribution of their ebooks. So now Simon & Schuster has control over how the prices are set, as opposed to Indigo River, who used to have it before. So it's like, I want this as an author. I want to offer the Kindle for cheap. But I'm not necessarily sure if that's going to happen. But so book two, like you said, is available for pre-order now, Awaken the Three. And then it will officially drop on August 11th. And I am super excited for that to happen.
Well, cost aside, it's going to be worth it. Whatever people end up paying, $2.99 or $29.99, it's worth it. The last two things I want to mention, real quick, what would you say to anybody else who's whatever their passion is? What would you say to them to encourage them, especially now when people are either stuck at home or, August is still too far away. This is true. What would you say to people who are trying to come up with something to, you know, express their passion?
My advice, and you know, it's the same advice that I give to anybody who asks me, what it takes to succeed as a writer. My advice to them is to absolutely go out and do it. Share your passion with someone. That's the most important part. And I think that, and I know that is what kept me going, and got me to finish book one. My favorite story to tell is about my friend Nicole, who I listed first in the acknowledgments of Gift of the Shaper. She and I have been friends since we were both about 15 years old. So, you know, two decades under our belt at least. And she had worked as an editor in England for a while. And she and I primarily exclusively spoke through email. But we were still really good friends and we kept in touch. And I had mentioned to her in passing, like, hey, I got about 7 or 8 chapters written of this idea I'm tossing around. I started it on deployment. Would you mind taking a look at it?
Sure.
And I still have the email that she sent to me. She said, Dave, this is her exact words. I can still quote them, 4 years later. She said, taking off my fan of Dave Jennings hat, if I were a literary agent, I would eat this up. And she proceeded to list about a page and a half of, she quoted excerpts from the book. She said, this is really well written here. I love this part. This is phrased really well. She was like, Dave, you are a good writer. And that was the first time that anyone had ever said that to me. And, sure. You know, to have someone say that to me and to realize, like, oh my God, this might actually be something worthwhile and worth sticking out. At that point, that was 100. I credit her 100% with why I finished the book in the first place. I don't think I would have done it without that positive feedback and that the words from her saying, like, you're a good writer, you should keep at this. Mm-hmm. So share your passion. Absolutely. Share it with someone. Constructive criticism is a real thing. It's very hard to take. But I've taken more than my fair share of it, and I firmly believe that it makes me a better writer. Mm-hmm. One of the hardest things to do is to ask people for constructive criticism. There are a lot of times when I would change things in the book, I would rephrase stuff, I would cut segments out because people said, like, hey, this doesn't really fit here. This is a strange, the book. Gift of the Shaper originally had a prologue, but one of my early beta readers that I trusted really well, Matt, not my brother Matt, but a different Matt, he wrote, this prologue is jarringly different. It has a different voice than chapter one. And I think it would be better if you just left it out. And I took it out. I cut the entire prologue out just based on that recommendation because I was like, you know what? You're right. I wrote this a lot later. It was an addition that I went back and I was like, ooh, this would be neat to kind of set up the action here.
Sure.
Start out with some action. Let's grab the reader. But it was great advice. It was really hard to take, but it was great advice. So someone who was asking for advice on how to cultivate a passion like that, I would absolutely say share it with people. Share it with people that you love, who are going to encourage you, because that's one of the best things that you can possibly do.
For sure. Well, thank you for saying that. I think a lot of people out there who are struggling with their talents or honing those talents, you know, they get stricken by some sort of fear that one person didn't like it or it's not good enough. And I try to convince people or help people understand that if it's what you love, you're going to cultivate it with practice and with time. I didn't learn how to draw a car the right way in the first year that I started drawing a car. My cars looked like crap. It actually took about 10 years to get to a point where somebody professional looked at it and said, okay, you know how to draw a car now. Sweet. All right. So I appreciate you, you sharing those words with us. The last thing I want to say is, I noticed that you're in sort of like what looks like a log cabin. Please, whatever you do, do not go down the same path that Jack Nicklaus did and freak out while writing a book. That's, don't do it.
It is way too late for that, my friend. I have gone past the point of madness and no return.
All right, dude, we got 10 seconds before this cuts us out, but I will do a follow-up on this just to thank you for it. And thank you to everybody who tuned in to this, and be good. Yeah, you're good. Video's done.